So this is, as I wrote on the top of the sheet, Parshas Behar. As Nechama noted, it's really a double Parsha this week. It's Behar B'chukosai. And the truth is that this topic will touch on B'chukosai also. But it's really dominantly a Behar topic, the benefits of Shemitah. The core mitzvah of Shemitah is presented multiple times, or I should say the core mitzvahs of Shemitah are presented multiple times in Chumash. And one of those appearances, one of the main appearances, is in Parshas Behar. And this focuses on what we call Shemitah's Karka, Shemitah of land, as opposed to Shemitah of loans, which gets its own separate treatment. So if you take a look at source number one, from the beginning of the Parsha, we get the introduction to this mitzvah. And I'll read out my translation that I brought you here. When you enter the land I'm giving you, and you know, as we were just talking about before, this is when they think that they're about to enter. They're getting ready to leave Har Sinai. It's the beginning of year two. When you enter the land I'm giving you, the land shall halt. A Shabbos for God. For 6 years you shall plant your field, for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard, and you shall gather its produce. And in the seventh year there will be a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the land, a Sabbath for God. You notice the language is very similar to that which we use for Shabbos of the week, right? 6 days you shall work, seventh day you stop, 6 years you shall work the land, seventh year you stop. You shall neither plant your field nor prune your vine. The wild growth of your harvest you shall not reap, the grapes of your unworked vine you shall not collect. It shall be a sabbatical year for the land. And the Sabbath of the land will be for you to eat, for you, your male and female servant, your hired hand, your settler who live with you, and for your animal and for the beast in your land shall be all of the produce to eat. So, you don't work the land, you don't plant it. Produce is rendered hefker, ownerless, and left open for anyone to take. You're not allowed to destroy the produce. You're not allowed to market it commercially. You have to get rid of it at the end of the year, is actually the rule. That's another rule. That's not part of this discussion. But at the end of the year, you actually have to eliminate it. We don't want you to be hoarding the produce. So at the end of the year, you have to get rid of it. Okay. So the question that I want to look at is a fairly straightforward question, which is, the Torah takes this mitzvah extremely seriously, much more than I would have expected to see in comparison to other mitzvahs. We're going to see just how seriously right now. And the question is going to be, why? What is it about this mitzvah that it's taken so seriously? So if you take a look at source number two, this is actually from Parshas Bechukosai. This is from the Tochacha, that set of warnings prior to what we think will be entering the land. And Hashem says, but if we don't follow the bris, the covenant with Hashem, you I shall scatter among the nations, I will unsheath the sword after you, your land shall be ruins, your city shall be destroyed, then the land shall enjoy her Sabbaths all the days of ruin, you shall be in the land of your enemies. Then the land will be destroyed, and she will enjoy her Sabbaths. All the days of ruin she shall halt, as she did not halt on your Sabbaths when you dwelled upon her. This is not talking about Shabbos. It's talking about Shemitah. And what it's saying is, you will be evicted from the land because you didn't give the land a break during Shemitah. You had your opportunities, and you didn't do so. So therefore, now the land gets a rest. So what we're told, essentially, it sounds like, is that we will be evicted from the land for failure to observe Shemitah. That's not something we are told for other mitzvos.
I also find it interesting how it seems like these are very harsh and strong commandments before they even enter the land. So it's almost like it's scary to them. Like, wow, but we didn't even see it, and you're already telling us what not to do. So is that kind of like, oh, and then there are giants? I don't know if we should really enter this land. Like, it's really scaring them before even seeing what it's all about.
Right. I mean, the giants, they don't know anything about at this stage. That's what the Meraglim are going to tell them. But but you're right. It's true. This is a very strong warning to be giving people who don't even know what this is. I mean, they've been told it's going to be good, and to be fair, they've been told it by Hashem, who has done everything for them, who has performed miracles for them every step of the way. Like, there should be a degree of trust by now. nonetheless, it's definitely true. This is a pretty a pretty strong introduction, as introductions go. One would have liked to have seen maybe something a little gentler, but yeah, you're right. And that underscores, you know, the importance of Shemitah. What is it about this mitzvah that warrants that Hashem should give this level of warning? And this is only on the national level. In source number 3, I brought you what we saw last week. It came up in the Shir in a different context last week, the Gemara in Kiddushin. Last week we were talking about whether you ostracize people who violate the law, what you do to people who for one reason or another are on the outs, and so this came up in that context. But now we're going to focus on the first part of the Gemara in source number 3, which tells us, Bo re'e kamakasha avka shel shvius. See how harsh is the powder of Shemitah. And what that means is the term avak is a term that's used in the Gemara to talk about a violation of something that is not the... Yeah? Sorry?
Is that also ribbis? Isn't there some sort of a...
Good.
...connection? Like...
Yeah, there's avak ribbis, there's avak shvius, there's avak lashon hara. Avak is usually a term that we use for sort of a lesser violation of a prohibition. We call it avak of the prohibition. There's more to be said about that, whether that's really what avak means, but that's not for right now. What they're trying to tell you is, even for a relatively light violation of Shemitah, specifically trafficking in Shemitah produce, when you look at Parshas Behar, and you see the sequence of portions, you see it talks about Shemitah, and then it talks about a person who sells off his family fields, and then it talks about a person who has a house in a walled city and he sells that off, and then it talks about someone who is sold into slavery. And so the Gemara does is it reads it as a chain of events. To say, if you are so greedy that you trade in Shemitah produce, you know what's going to happen? Then you're going to sell off other stuff. And then you're going to sell off your family fields. And then you're going to sell off your house in the walled city. And then your daughter. And then you're going to borrow money for interest, which is the next sequence, the next piece there in the Parsha. And you ultimately sell yourself off to idolaters, and yourself become an idolater. What started it? Violating Shvius, violating Shemitah, even on a light level. So we're taking Shemitah really, really seriously here. And the question again is, why? What is it about leaving the land fallow and letting people come in and take the produce out of your field? What is it about that that is so important? What would you say, without having looked at the sources yet?
I think it's showing Hashem that we have complete trust in Him, that really ultimately all comes down to Him and what He decides, how much is given to each person. And as a landowner, you know, there's only so much you could do, and He'll give you whatever is intended for you to receive. And for the people to take, they're also entitled to take whatever they want, and you don't really have control over that as well. Whatever they take from you is what's meant to be taken from.
Right, so there's an element of trust in Hashem, essentially. Right?
There's an element of just sense of community, right, mm-hmm. that you give to the others and you don't keep everything for yourself.
Good, a sense of community, the relationships with other people. This is definitely a piece of it. What else? These are all true. Okay, well, what I'm going to do is try to show you 4 different benefits of Shemitah. And the truth is, some of the benefits have subcategories as well within them. But there are 4 different ways in which Shemitah is extremely important. First, yeah, Nachama.
Is there maybe a connection to the Chita Egel? You know, have patience, wait a little bit, don't be so quick to, you know, react or don't expect something right away, because it'll eventually come. So there's that smichas there that they should kind of have learned from that. And
what should they have learned? In other words, what you're saying in terms of Shemitah, right? So what is it that they should have learned?
That there's nothing wrong with you know, the patience and waiting, and Hashem has a plan for everything, and it doesn't have to be at this exact time. Hashem knows what's meant to be, and...
Got it. So yes, we're gonna get to an idea that I think is what you're getting at. The word I would use is bitachon. But yes, we will get to that as well. I think you're correct. So the first of the four areas that I look at is improving our midos, improving our character. And here I give you three ways in which Shemitah helps us improve our character. First of all, in source number four, Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, in Chorev, says something about the way Shemitah works. He says, in externals too, Israel was supposed to be a people among peoples. For this purpose, God gave Israel its own place on the earth for its own special tasks. Every nation has its land. We do too. In order, however, that Israel's land, intended for the realization of Israel's task, should not, through the sin of pride of possession, become the cause of Israel's downfall, God ordained Shemitah, Yovel, Bikurim, Truma, Meiser, Challah in conjunction with Israel's own soil. We have all of these mitzvos. And now he goes into Shemitah specifically. Shemitah and Yovel affirm God as owner, by right, of all property. They also, through the prohibition of work on the land, express for the Holy Land the lesson which Shabbos conveys in connection with lordship of the earth. In other words, Shabbos says, you don't own the world, Hashem created it, you stop creating. So too, that's what Shemitah will provide in terms of the land of Israel. It affirms that Hashem owns it and keeps us from becoming arrogant. And that's one way in which it shapes our character. Ruh's arrogance. Second, the Sefer Achinuch, in source number 5, he has multiple ideas for Shemitah, and we're going to come back to him, but this is one of his points. He says, another benefit found in the matter is to acquire with this the trait of generosity. There is no one as generous as a person who gives without hope for reciprocation. Right? What we call chesed shel emes. When you give without expecting that someone else is going to give you something back, that is a unique form of chesed. It is a special form of chesed. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, well, that's what's happening here. You open the field wide. People who don't have fields are going to come in and take. And you have no expectation that they're going to give you something in return. There's no interaction at all. So therefore, it makes you generous. And that's another way in which it shapes our character. And third, in a very different vein, it makes us more spiritual people. Because what do? When you spend the year not planting, and you spend the year not plowing, and not harvesting, so what are you going to do with all that time on your hands? You'll sit in quarantine and, watch things on Zoom. No, what you're going to do is you're going to learn more Torah. That's the expectation. Source number 6 of Yitzchak Arama, the Akedas Yitzchak. In truth, it is but to address our souls, open our ears, and stir our hearts, providing great and numerous signs, opening blind eyes that are sunk deep in thoughts of our desires. For in the cycle of 7 years of working, the seventh being a Sabbath year, he stirs our hearts and sounds in our ears that we were not sent here to be slaves sold to the soil, but for quite a different and lofty purpose. The point is that entering the land was not for the purpose of becoming slaves to it, working the soil to derive benefit from it and store its fruit gathered by the handful. That's not our goal. You get a Shemitah year, it's an opportunity to sit out the rat race. It's an opportunity to say, okay, take a step back. That wasn't what I was doing. It's a sabbatical. That's literally what it is. It's a sabbatical. Yeah, Nechama.
You mean? I think that's a great connection for Shabbos.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I gave a shiur on, a couple of weeks ago, about the poetry of Rav Kook, and specifically his poetry of Geula, of redemption. And the first poem that I presented was actually one that I used in a bencher for one of my kids for their bat mitzvah. It's a poem in which he describes Moshe addressing Paro and saying to Paro that it's time to free the Jews. And saying to him, look at the... He doesn't actually speak about the freedom in the poem, but he says, look what slavery does. People aren't meant to be so immersed in the mundane. People need a break from that because it's not why we're created. It's not what we're suited for. We're suited for spiritual growth and elevation, and indeed, that's what Shabbos is about. That's that opportunity. And Rav Kook says it in here, in his introduction to Shabbat Haaretz. Shabbat Haaretz is Rav Kook's halacha sefer on Shemitah. But in his introduction, he waxes poetic. And he says, that which Shabbos accomplishes for each individual, Shemitah accomplishes for the nation as a whole. And if that brutality, which must accompany the structure of ongoing communal life, reduces the gentle character of ethical life, then halting the social order in specific ways from time to time brings this nation, when it is established on its foundation, to powerful elevation to the heights of the inner traits of ethical, spiritual life. We become better, we become more spiritual, when we are not focused on working the land. Shabbos does it for us during the week. Shemitah does it as a full year. So, I have to admit, and I think people are seeing this in quarantine, that it's actually hard to take advantage of an opportunity like this. Meaning, you're going to see, realistically, after all of this, when everything is reopened and people are now going back to work, you're going to see a lot of people who are going to express regret about, you know, I didn't take advantage of the time that I had. I had myself a sabbatical, I had time with my kids, I had time to be around the house, and what did I do? I sat there moaning about how I couldn't get out, and I couldn't go to the office, and I couldn't do all these other things. What a fool I was. It takes a certain presence of mind to think through, how do I take advantage of this? What do I want to accomplish with it? You need a set of goals in order for it to be meaningful. And I think that that's really, you know, what's necessary in order for Shemitah to work. Otherwise, it's just, hey, I can't farm. Can't wait till I can go back and farm. And then you've lost that opportunity. It's gone. But this is first approach. Shemitah is about improving our character, preventing arrogance, making us giving people, and making us more spiritual people. But now let's switch focus. That's one, improving who we are. Second, it's about improving our world. And the Rambam says that in a very literal way, in source number 8, Mor Nebuchim. In truth, all of the mitzvot we enumerated in the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, some of them are merciful for people, create opportunities for all people. As it is written, the poor of your nation will eat, and so on. So some aspect of it is that it's mercy upon us. But then he writes, and help the land increase its production and become stronger when it lies fallow. And then some of the mitzvot are to help the avadim and the poor and so on. But he highlights this practical thing. Let the land rest, it'll produce better next year.
That's true. Is that proven? Like when he said it at the time?
So the answer is yes and no. The answer, as I understand it, agriculturally, is yes and no. Meaning there is a concept called crop rotation, in which you plant things, you know, plant one variety in the field this year, a different variety the next year. The more sophisticated way to do it, as I understand it, is that actually you plant different things which will require different balances of nutrients and restore different nutrients to the soil. So there's actually a synergy going on between them. Having said that, I think, yes, there is something to be said for the idea that you simply restore the nutrients in the soil by not drawing them out every year by planting. So I think there is something to be said for that as an agricultural mechanism. Okay. Now, he's very practical about how this benefits the land. On the other hand, you have others who are way mystical about the way you are benefiting not the land, but the universe. And here you get a fascinating idea. The Or HaChaim, in source number 9, says that when Hashem created the world, it was on a clock. A Shabbos clock, so to speak. Take a look at number 9. We have found that God revealed the matter when he said in the Aseres Adibros, for 6 days God created the heavens, etc. He revealed that during creation, God created the world only to endure for 6 days. For a reason known to him, the original creation was on a clock. You got 6 days. That's it. And God cleverly created one day known to God, and on that day he again sends light to the world, a measure which will last for another 6 days, and so on in this manner. So each week, we observe Shabbos, and Hashem adds another week. Without this day, the world would be ruined at the end of 6 days. It would return to Tohu and Vohu, and God would need to create it anew. Via Shabbos, the world endures. Thus it says, for in this, in this specifically, meaning Kivo, on that day, meaning for through this day, God was able to halt his malacha. Because of this day, God no longer needs to create. Right? Kivo Shavas. Because of that day, not on that day Hashem halted, but because of that day, Hashem was able to halt. That's what the Or HaChaim says regarding Shabbos. So,
call the Chomer, how much more us?
What do you mean?
If Hashem was able to take a rest, then definitely us as humans, he doesn't need it, then
so that,
he could have...
Right, so that's a different idea. I think it's an important idea. But what the Or HaChaim is doing is he's saying Hashem actually would have had to keep on creating in order for the world to continue to exist. He would have had to create it anew. But because there's a Shabbos, Hashem doesn't need to create it anew. Because there's a Shabbos, it endures. And every Shabbos, when we keep Shabbos, that actually means that the world will exist for another week and Hashem will not need to create it. It's a very out there idea. It's not a simple idea. But Rishmuel Asachachav, the Sachachaver, in the Shemu Shmuel, actually says the same thing for Shemitah. Take a look at source number 10. It must be said that assigning the land of Israel to Israel is like creation in general. The land was given to them only for 7 years to work it, and then he gives it again for another 7 years to be worked and cared for. Therefore, on the seventh year, the land reverts to the God who gave it, and all who eat of its fruits partake from his lofty table. Every 7 years, it reverts to being God's, and it's renewed in this way. Therefore, the introduction, when you enter the land that I assign you, that we read right back in the beginning, in source number one, when you enter the land I'm giving you, is in the present tense, to indicate the act of giving you the land is continuous, not once for all time. This is how you get the land. Because of Shemitah, it renews your claim. It's like you went to the library, you took out a book, and every week you have to renew it. That's what you're doing with Shemitah. You are renewing your right to the land. That's the concept. So our first approach was Shemitah improves our character, prevents arrogance, makes us generous people, makes us spiritual people. Our second approach is it benefits the world, either on a practical level, benefits the land, Rambam, or in a spiritual way, it renews our claim to the universe. It renews the universe's claim to existence, Or HaChaim / Shem Bishmuel. And then a third idea, which goes back towards what Goldie was saying before, about the way we look out for each other. It helps us to build a proper Jewish nation. The Otzer Chaim has a very interesting story of the Radomsk Rebbe, Rav Shlomo HaKohen of Radomsk, on Parashas Behar is where he presents it. And I gave you a little summary of the story in source number 11, interspersed with the Radomsk Rebbe's lines within it. So you can see the story there. Sometime in the middle of the 19th century, South Central Poland suffered from a wheat shortage. The price skyrocketed. A measure of grain went for 10, 12, or more rubles. Seeing an opportunity, a group of Radomsk Hasidim invested heavily, buying everything they could get, right? The grain goes up in value, they say, let's buy it. Price rises. They leveraged assets to borrow and invest further. But then large shipments of grain came in. The price tanked. They're now broke. So the group approached Rav Shlomo HaKohen, the Rebbe of Radomsk, and pleaded, have mercy on us, daven for us, daven to Hashem for the price of wheat to recover, or we'll lose everything. The Rebbe of Radomsk replied, no, my masters, that we do not pray for food that has become cheaper. We don't say, oh no, make food more expensive. We don't ask for mercy regarding a surplus of good. There's too much good, let's get rid of it. So the Hasidim come back to him and say, but we're going to have nothing. What's going to happen to us? And the Rebbe responded, put your minds at rest. The one who aided the poor provided them with food when prices were high. He'll help and support you when prices are low. That's his very sharp response to his Hasidim. You don't daven for food to become more expensive. And if you go broke, you go broke. God will take care of you also. Don't worry about it. But you don't daven for food to become more expensive. And the underlying point, the message here, is the message of our parsha. It's very easy to miss this. Take a look at source number 12. This is from Parshas Behar again, in our section about Shemitah. We're told that we're supposed to leave the land fallow, right? So the pasuk says, V'chisom ru, and when you say, Manochal bashana shviyis, what am I going to eat in the seventh year? Hey, lo nizra, we're not going to plant, v'lo nesofis tefoseinu, we're not going to harvest our produce, right? That's your objection. And Hashem says, don't worry about it, I'll take care of you. But think more about what it is that we're asking there. What will we eat in the seventh year? We will not plant, and we will not harvest our produce. Tell me something. Where could you have stopped that sentence? And it still would have made perfect sense.
Right after the seventh year.
Well, you haven't yet explained why you're worried about what you're going to eat. You still need to give a reason for why you're worried.
Oh, so then no planting.
Yeah. You could have said, Manocha bashana shviyis hein lo nizra. Right? What are we going to eat in the seventh year if we're not going to plant anything? But the problem is that there's an additional question. Not only are we not going to plant, we're also going to give away whatever we have. And therefore, we're going to be hungry. And the Radomska Rebbe is saying that's the wrong question. Don't say, how am I going to eat if I'm giving things away to others? Giving things away to others, God will take care of you. That's not your problem. That's not your headache. And that goes back again to the idea in the Sefer HaChinuch about learning generosity. Shemitah teaches us, as Goldie said before, to look out for each other. And I think it's particularly important, right? I go back to my initial question. Why is it that the Parsha places such emphasis here, B'chukosai, in the Gemara and Kiddushin? If we don't have Shemitah, we lose the land, everything is gone. Right? The individual becomes lost. Why is that? So first of all, because Shemitah helps to improve our character. It's critical for that purpose in multiple ways. Second, because it's important for the sake of the world, practically as well as mystically. And third, because Shemitah is really about building a nation in Israel via responsibility for each other. A nation that is not going to say, what about me? I'm not going to have because I gave something away. But a nation that instead is going to insist on looking after the needs of others, even in advance of our own. Not to look at the others as, that's other, I'm not worried about them. No. Their needs are my needs. You follow? That's the key here. It's about building a nation. And then a fourth and last approach. It's about improving our connection with Hashem. And this goes back towards what Nechama was saying in the beginning as well. It's about improving our relationship with Hashem, and again, in multiple ways. First of all, Shemitah reminds us, and we saw this before in Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, it reminds us of creation. Reminds us that everything belongs to God. Right? Take a look at source number 13, Gemara in Sanhedrin. Hashem said to the Jewish people, plant for 6 years and leave the field fallow in the seventh, so that you will know the world is mine, God says. You need to know the world belongs to me, capital M. It's a reminder that Hashem created it. Part of that, as Hirsch said, is about losing that arrogance. I should say Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. I don't like when people say Hirsch. It's about not being arrogant, but part of it is the positive side. It's not only about don't be arrogant, it's recognize what Hashem did for us. And the Sefer HaChinuch says it here in source number 14. Among the roots of this mitzvah is to establish in our hearts and to create a strong image in our thoughts regarding the creation of the world. For God created heaven and earth in 6 days, and on the seventh he did not create, and he wrote that he rested. So it reminds us that Hashem made the world in which we live. That's number one. Number two, still within this idea about our relationship with Hashem, it compels us to rely on Hashem for support. And that's the rest of source number 14 from the Sefer HaChinuch. Another benefit is found in that a person increases his trust in God. This goes back to what Natsama was saying. Anyone who finds it in his heart to give and abandon to the world all of the year's produce of his lands and of his ancestral portion, and who is trained in that, him and his family for all his days, will never be gripped by the trait of miserliness or lack of faith. If you can learn to give away everything, then you'll never have a problem with emunah. You achieve that goal, you'll never have a problem with trusting in God. And I think that's critical, because this is something that is a theme in Tanakh. One of the problems with Tanakh is that the themes shift as you go through it. And if you never learn a particular section, you never reach those themes that are in that section. Meaning, I can learn Yehoshua Shoftim, Shmuel, and never come across the themes that are in Malachim. Some things in Malachim are really Malachim specific. And one of those themes that I find much more in Malachim, maybe I'm just not as sensitive to it in the rest of Tanakh, I don't know, but I find much more starting in Shmuel and then going into Malachim is the theme of testing our emunah, our faith. Are we going to do what Hashem has told us to do, even when it looks unwise? And you see it with the kings. You see it with King Asa. You see it with Yehoshaphat. You see it with Ahaz. You see it with Hezekiah. Time after time, they are placed in positions in which they're in danger. And the Navi says to them, don't worry about it, God's got it. And then it's as though they're just supposed to say, okay, fine, I'm not doing anything. Hashem's got it. Not to worry. I brought you source number 15. I didn't bring you an English translation of it. I got a little lazy with it. You can look it up. But I'm going to go through this story with you quickly, and you'll see what I'm talking about. This is a story involving King Yehoshaphat. You can see the Hebrew. I'm going to give you English along the way and just, you know, do a rough translation. The nations of Moab and Ammon came to attack Yehoshaphat. News comes to Yehoshaphat saying, this great mass is coming to fight us from Aram, there in Chatzitzon Tamar, which is En Gedi. And he's very afraid. And he turns to God. And he declares a fast for all the people in Yehuda. Right, Yehuda, because this is after the southern kingdom is separate from the northern kingdom already. So Yehuda's the southern kingdom. He says, everybody in Yehuda has to fast. And all Yehuda gathers to daven to Hashem. Pasuk Hey. Yehoshaphat stands up among this great mass of Jews at the Beis HaMikdash, and he declares, Hashem, God of our ancestors, you are the God in the heavens. You rule over all the nations. Nothing can stand with you. You gave us this land. You gave it to the descendants of Abraham. I'm in Pasuk Ches. They lived there. They built a Beis HaMikdash in your name with an idea which Shlomo HaMelech said, that if we would ever be attacked by the sword, if there were a plague, if there were a famine, we should be able to come to this house and cry out to you, and you would save us. Which is what it says, in fact, in Malachim Aleph, when Shlomo dedicates the Beis HaMikdash. And now he says, we have problems. Ammon, Moab, Seir, these people who you didn't give to us were across the Yarden. Right? All these people, we didn't fight them. We weren't supposed to fight them. Well, guess what? Now they're trying to kick us out of the land. God, you have to do something about it. We don't know what to do. Everybody is standing there before God, waiting to see what's going to happen. Their children are there. Their wives are there. And Pasuk Yudalid, Yahaziel, son of Zechariah, son of Benaiah, son of Ye'iel, son of Matanya Halevi, from the descendants of Asaph, Leviim. This person has a Ruach Hashem, a spirit of God, while he's there. and he declares, "Listen up, people of Yehuda, listen up, King Yehoshaphat, this is what God says. Do not be afraid of this mass of people who are coming to attack you. War is not for you. War is for God. So here's what I want you to do. Tomorrow, go to them. They will be ascending towards you. Okay? You will find them out there. You will not have to stand and you don't have to fight them. You will stand there and see the salvation of Hashem. Hisyatzvu, stand there like at Yam Suf. And you will see the salvation of God with you. Do not be afraid. Don't worry about it." Pasuk Yuches, Yehoshaphat bows before God. All the people of Yehuda, the dwellers of Yerushalayim, fall before God. The Levium get up to sing to God, and in Pasuk Chaf, they get up in the morning, and they go out to Midbar Tekoa, and as they're going, Yehoshaphat stands up, and he says, "Listen up, Yehuda, dwellers of Yerushalayim, trust in Hashem, and you will endure." Alina, you'll recall in Yeshaya, we invoke this Pasuk, because Yeshaya plays with this Pasuk in one of his messages. But he says here, Yehoshaphat says, "Listen to God, and you will endure." And that's what they do. They turn to God, the singers start singing, and so on. And as they start to sing, Hashem sends attackers against Ammon and Moab and Seir, and Ammon and Moab and Seir are defeated in a battle that we had nothing to do with. We just stood there and watched. It's an act of supreme loyalty to Hashem, or supreme foolishness, right? For a king and his people to say, "We're under attack and we're going to do nothing." But that's what the Navi told him to do. And that's what he does. And that, to me, is the fourth aspect of Shemitah. It's a very difficult thing to do, really, to stand up to a test like that. But that's the idea. Shemitah is critical in terms of improving our character, making us humble, making us people of chesed, making us people of spirituality who are not constantly embedded in working the land. Shemitah is critical as it benefits the world practically and mystically. Shemitah is critical because it builds a nation that takes responsibility for each other and doesn't just ask, "What's in it for me?" And Shemitah is critical because it improves our relationship with Hashem, reminds us of creation, and compels us to rely on Hashem for support. It's a test of just how far we're willing to go in that bitachon, in that trust in Hashem. And for all of those reasons, it is such a vital mitzvah that Hashem is willing to say in Bechukosai, that's what it's all about. You don't do that, you're going to get kicked out. But you do it, this land will be yours as long as you exist. That's the, to me, all of these are the benefits of Shemitah.